The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 10th, 2017, special edition, A Person of Flintrest. The country woke up this morning to a remarkable story in the Wall Street Journal. A planned kidnapping, a very large sum of money, and a new front in the Mueller investigation. We put together a quick and dirty podcast with Shane Harris, one of the two reporters on the story, with Ryan Evans, editor of War on the Rocks and an expert on all things Turkey and Fethullah Gulen, the putative victim of the kidnapping. Paul Rosenzweig, veteran of the Kenstar investigation and longtime Lawfare contributor, and Steve Vladek of the University of Texas and also a Lawfare contributor. They all joined Susan Hennessy and me for an hour of conversation about what the heck to make of this latest story, what it means, and where it's all going. It's the Lawfare Podcast, special edition, A Person of Flintrest.
Let's kick this off with a discussion with Shane Harris, one of the two reporters on this morning's story, and with Ryan Evans of War on the Rocks. They joined Susan Hennessy and me this morning by recorded conference call. So Shane, that's quite a story. We woke up this morning to a big bang from the Wall Street Journal, or maybe I should say a big boom from the Wall Street Journal. Give us the overview.
Yes, a big cannon boom. So we reported in the Journal this morning that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, is investigating an alleged plot involving Michael Flynn, the former White House National Security Advisor, to forcibly remove a man named Fethullah Gulen from the United States. And under this alleged plan, Flynn and his son were to be paid as much as $15 million for their role in extracting Gulen outside the legal process. Turkey views Gulen as an enemy of the state. President Erdogan has blamed him for a failed coup attempt last summer. The crux of this really goes to two things. One, we knew already that Flynn had entertained, I think is perhaps the right way to phrase this, in a meeting in September 2016, the possibility of some kind of a plan to whisk Gulen out of the country. And it appears that that went from a blue sky kind of spitballing session in September that he had with two senior Turkish representatives, including the foreign minister, to a more let's get down to brass tacks discussion in mid-December in a meeting that occurred at the 21 Club, which is the restaurant in New York that the president frequents. And it was there we understand that more of the details for this plan were being hashed out. And it is that interview, that meeting, that at least four people we know of have been asked about by FBI agents working in the special counsel's probe who want to know more about Flynn's role and what he may have been doing to arrange the extra-legal removal, extraction, I think some would probably use the word kidnapping, of this cleric from his home in Pennsylvania.
So there's a little bit of ambiguity in the story, or maybe I should say not ambiguity, but duality, right? In some passages in the story, you refer to it as a forcible extrajudicial removal. And in some passages, you say that the issue was, in addition, Flynn using his influence as the incoming national security advisor to effectuate an extradition. And I'm wondering if you have a sense of what the balance was. Is this primarily a kidnapping plot and a rendition plot, or is it fundamentally an influence peddling story where a foreign government seems to be willing to pay up to $15 million for the national security advisor to try to effectuate a legal removal?
I think the plan incorporates all of those possibilities. And I think we need to make a distinction between the discussion that was had in September of 2016, which we'd previously reported in the journal, and the one that occurs in December. And the reason I think that is because in September, Mike Flynn is an advisor to a campaign. In December, he is the national security designate. In the September meeting, Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director, was present, and he said to us, and this is publicly in other venues, that what he heard was a plan to, in his words, whisk this guy away in the dead of night, and he felt it was illegal if it were to be carried out. And our understanding is that conversation continued, and the possibility of doing that moved forward even after the election. One person we interviewed who spoke to FBI agents about this said that there was a discussion of using a private aircraft to remove Gulen from the U.S. and take him to an island prison off the coast of Turkey. And then another person also said under discussion was this possibility of Mike Flynn using his influence in the White House. So it appears from our reporting that it was a plan that encompassed the possibility of both legal and extra-legal means, which I have to say makes it even more baffling, because why would Michael Flynn, as the national security advisor, first of all, why would he even be discussing this in the first place, a possible kidnapping plot? But once he becomes the White House national security advisor, presumably he is in some position of influence to affect the legal process here. I think this explains one of the reasons why the FBI is trying to get to the bottom of this and to sort out what exactly did he commit to, if anything. There's no indication any money changed hands, but there seems to be a pretty obvious allegation of quid pro quo here, which I think in and of itself would potentially be illegal.
Can I ask a point of clarification? Is your sense that this plan was something that was supposed to be carried out after Donald Trump took office?
That is our understanding. There's no indication that this was imminent and that Mike Flynn was going to use his influence to do this. And we know, too, that he was prepared to use his influence and did try to use it as a former senior intelligence official who had spoken frequently about the threat from Islamic extremism, and he sees it because he published an op-ed about Gulen calling him an Islamic extremist on the day of the election. I think it's safe to say Mike Flynn, you know, didn't think that Donald Trump was going to win the election, but he was prepared to continue using his influence in that way as a public figure and someone that is regarded in some circles as an expert on the subject.
So, Shane, one of the things when I posted this on Twitter this morning, a whole bunch of people responded to the story by saying, this is old news. The Journal reported this a long time ago, and there was a lot of grumbling among tweeps about the mainstream media being behind, you know, the Louise Menches of the world. And so I want you to walk through what is new here and what is not.
The first thing that is new here is the fact that there was a second meeting at which this plot is allegedly discussed. We reported, it's true, back in September that there was a meeting that Flynn had with Erdogan's son-in-law and the Turkish foreign minister in a hotel in New York during the UN General Assembly. That's sort of meeting one, as we understand it. Meeting two occurs in December, and what's new there is that is after the election. It is after the time, the moment that that Mike Flynn has been named the White House National Security Advisor. So he is acting in with a different authority, arguably. And as we understand it, this plan goes from being sort of blue sky and theoretical to getting down more to the details. The other new thing about this is that the FBI is specifically investigating that conversation that occurred at the 21 Club and has interviewed people about it. So I think when people are saying that this is old news, I think this is more the way to look at this is that next chapter in this particular storyline. And I think the way to see this is that it's certainly being taken seriously by the Bureau, and the December meeting indicates that this went from being sort of a just plan with people talking out loud to people sitting down and saying, well, how would we do this if we were to do it, and the proposal containing a dollar figure, millions of dollars being paid to Mike Flynn and his son is what people who are familiar with this meeting are telling us. That is far more significant than some people sitting around a hotel room and just kind of thinking out loud about something that itself might be illegal, but that hasn't progressed or matured to any point where they are seriously contemplating doing it for money.
So, Shane, there's been recent reporting saying that Robert Mueller's sort of team has enough evidence to indict both Flynn and Flynn Jr. Is your sense that sort of reporting about, well, they have enough now to move forward, is connected to this story, or is it connected to sort of other, you know, FARA violations or false statements types of charges? What's your sense about whether or not there's any connection between those sort of reports and rumors and this one?
Well, my sense is that, you know, two things. One, it's been pretty clear to us from our previous reporting that the FARA violations that Mike Flynn may have committed are certainly things that Mueller is looking at and that put him in some legal jeopardy. But it's also been our sense from our reporting that failure to file his forms properly on time was sort of the least of his concerns that he faced. NBC has done some really good reporting on this too, and credit to them and my good friend Carol Lee over there, who I used to work with at the Journal, who are reports on this. I think you do have to assume that Mueller is looking at this meeting with an eye towards whether this is in fact, you know, some kind of illegal activity. Now, whether this is something that is in his draft indictment, I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows that. But certainly his work for Turkey, we think from our sources, is of interest to the special counsel, not simply because he didn't report it accurately or on time.
So it's fair to say that what's new here, in to distill it to a sentence, is that Special Counsel Robert Mueller, A, is investigating whether National Security Advisor Designate Mike Flynn, B, during the transition, C, was working on a plot to kidnap somebody and render him to a foreign government, and or use his influence as National Security Advisor to effectuate his removal by extradition, I've lost count of my letters, in exchange for money. Large sums of money, right? All of that is new.
That's right. That's where you have summarized it nicely.
Okay, Ryan, help us out. Who the heck is Fethullah Gulen, and why does President Erdogan care enough about him to contemplate something like this?
So it's a long story, and I'm going to try to make it as sort of punchy as possible. But basically, depending on who you believe, Gulen is either a James Bond movie-style conspiratorial mastermind sitting at the head of this nefarious global movement, or he is a religious man that just wants to do good, build schools, and help people, and help Turkey. The irony of all this is that Erdogan, when he launched his political party, the Justice and Development Party, and then shortly thereafter became prime minister, Gulen was perhaps his most important political ally. He sort of helped clear the way for him in the media. He gave him all sorts of access and help and to sort of launch this new party that ended up tremendously successful. It was part of Erdogan's initial coalition. But at some point, several years later, the relationship started to go south. And there's lots of reasons for this. We don't need to get into it. A lot of it had to do with control over what faction was going to control the police, because they were sort of clearing out the secularists from the judiciary, law enforcement, the military, who was going to control these important institutions. Some of it had to do with revenue from educational institutions that Gulen was setting up in Turkey and abroad. But they started to fall out. And then you sort of had this funny situation where if you asked people, people on the right in the United States what the Gulen movement was, you'd say, oh, they're a bunch of, hard right Islamists. If you asked nationalists in Turkey what the Gulen movement was, they would say, oh, they're secret Zionists and homosexuals. So the sort of depictions of this movement diverged dramatically, depending on who you asked. And, just in the interest of disclosure, like, I studied Turkish at a Gulen institution here in Washington, D.C.
And so I'm asking you, what is, in your judgment, the best way to understand who Gulen is?
I think there are different levels to this movement. They are a charitable movement. They are an educational movement. And these are things that genuinely matter to them. And these are things that they genuinely do out of the goodness of their hearts. But they are also a Turkey-focused political faction. And like most people, most factions, most organizations, movements that become involved in Turkish politics, there's a sort of very hard edge, realpolitik side to things. And Gulen understood that to really change Turkey from the sort of Ataturk secularist model that it was, you had to reform society from the bottom up. And that's what he's been patiently engaged in doing through education, activism, but also some conspiratorial activities, including with the current Turkish government several years ago, over the years.
So how did he end up in Pennsylvania?
So he left. There's been a series of coups in Turkey, and he didn't feel that it was safe for him to go back to Turkey. And so I believe it was in 1999, he requested and received asylum in Pennsylvania. The last Turkish coup was in 97, and he just didn't feel like it was a safe place for him to be anymore. And so that's why the word Pennsylvania is mentioned all the time in the Turkish press as the center of conspiracy.
Right. And the other word that you always hear in connection with Fethullah Gulen is compound, which has a sort of vaguely David Koresh-like quality. When you first heard that there might have been a plot between the Trump campaign/transition and the Turkish government to either forcibly remove Gulen in the dead of night or to do it in a sort of, cash for influence scheme through the legal system. What was your reaction to it? Why would the Turkish government care enough to do this in a sort of contract with Mike Flynn to do something like this?
So from the Turkish side, things came to a head with the coup attempt in the summer of 2015. July 2015, there was a massive coup attempt that was very unsuccessful. Hundreds of people were killed, where basically parts of the military, certainly with some sort of Gulenist involvement, although it's unclear the extent of it, rose up and tried to overthrow Erdogan and the AKP government. And they actually came very, very close to succeeding. Immediately, while it was still happening, Erdogan blamed the Gulen movement. And it seemed sort of a bit farcical at the time, because how could they know? And then they immediately started arresting people as soon as the coup attempt failed from the movement, university professors who had nothing to do with the coup attempt, civil society activists, journalists, banks. And so they moved so fast that it seemed like the allegations they were making about Gulenist involvement were sort of not credible, because there's no way there was some sort of real investigation conducted to determine the facts of who planned the coup, who commanded it, who executed it. What we now know is that there was about to be a purge in the senior ranks of the military that summer. And that purge was going to target a lot of senior Gulenists who were at this point senior officers in the military, who became senior officers themselves after purging secularists from the military with Erdogan's help. But not just Gulenists, also the remaining secular officers were set to be supposedly purged as well. And so it seems like this coalition acted. But there is no evidence that has been presented that Gulen, the person, the man himself, knew this was going to happen. And all the evidence the Turkish government has tried to present is full of holes. But they've been demanding ever since the coup that the U.S. extradite Gulen to Turkey. And Washington has been saying that, well, we have an extradition treaty, but there are certain standards of evidence that you need to present. And they've been at loggerheads ever since. So it didn't surprise me too much that when someone as unsavory as Donald Trump was coming into office and the people around him like Mike Flynn, that they maybe tried to make a go at it. Although I remember when I first heard about it, it struck me as particularly audacious. You don't want to be surprised by anything the Trump administration does anymore, but you still manage to be surprised and shocked.
So, Ryan, can I ask you, as someone who sort of has obviously, follows this issue pretty closely, is there anything sort of that in terms of statements from President Trump himself or anything sort of in terms of a shift in U.S. policy towards Turkey that strikes you as the kind of thing that raises your suspicions about, you know, Flynn's influence, or that this is somehow tied to broader administrative efforts or higher level figures? Or is your sense, no, this is really, you know, we heard statements and op-eds from Flynn himself, but that didn't really seem to be sort of picked up by the rest of Trump's foreign policy team or Trump himself?
It doesn't seem that U.S. foreign policy towards Turkey has changed that much since the Obama administration, the transition to the Trump administration. You know, the one thing we do have is Trump's sort of affinity for autocrats, even when they're doing terrible things. We just saw it on display with Trump and Xi this week, but we've seen it on display with Trump and Erdogan as well. But there's been no real change in policy. We're still supporting people they don't like in Syria to kill ISIS, where they're still in NATO. The big outlines of U.S. policy as it affects Turkey hasn't really changed. But I think the Mike Flynn element of this is just the most interesting part, because on the evening of the coup attempt, Flynn was by coincidence giving a speech somewhere, and there's a video of this online. And he actually, when he heard the reports that the coup attempt was failing, he expressed regret because he didn't like the Erdogan government. He thought they were sort of not so secret Islamists. And they needed to, it would have been not a bad thing if they were done away with. And then fast forward, and we see Flynn writing op-eds in favor of Erdogan and the Turkish government in some of their hardest line positions. And what seems to have changed is Mike Flynn got paid.
Shane, how much has Mike Flynn been paid?
We know from lobbying records that he disclosed that there was $530,000 in payments. And that is essentially for the kind of the public relations campaign, if you want to think of it that way, that he was engaged in to try and bring attention to Gulen and to criticize him. And the in the op-ed that he wrote on election day, that ran on election day, is an example of that. I think it strikes a lot of people as a significant amount of money, but not necessarily a huge amount of money by lobbying standards, which is certainly one of the reasons why the talk of millions of dollars in payments, I think, has piqued the interest, it appears, of FBI investigators. But right now, the known universe of what we're looking at in terms of what he was paid is about $500,000.
Okay. Thank you both.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Later this morning, I chatted with Paul Rosenzweig about his impressions of the story and its meaning for the future of the Mueller investigation.
Paul, how many different laws jump to your mind when you read this story?
Jeez. More than I can readily enumerate on one hand. Let's begin with a conspiracy, possibly a racketeering charge, a RICO charge, kidnapping and attempted kidnapping, which are state crimes and also federal crimes, violations of the of all sorts of foreign registration and agency acts, not up to and including like the old Chestnut, the Logan Act from the 1790s about negotiating as a private individual with a foreign nation, assault, an attempted assault.
Well, it's not an attempt, right? Because it's like they didn't actually try it.
Well,
right?
Conspiracy to assault, right? Conspiracy to assault, conspiracy to kidnap. I mean, you know, in some ways, this is a classic conspiratorial case where they've made a plan and provided you have one act in furtherance of the conspiracy, it's a completed federal offense.
Okay, so what counts as an act in furtherance of the conspiracy? You have, according to the story, the FBI is investigating a meeting that takes place, right? The meeting, once you've had the September meeting and you've agreed to keep talking about it, and then you have the December meeting, you're done for conspiracy purposes?
Well, you know, you've done, a conspiracy requires both an agreement to do that and acts in furtherance of the offense. We've now got two. Add in any phone call, any purchase of equipment, any acceptance of money or transfer of money, and the acts multiply. The overt acts of an offense will be the listed steps that were taken in furtherance of the conspiracy. Now, to be fair, typically conspiracy charges relate to offenses where some of the overt acts involve actual physical attempts to do something, if not completed offenses, like you buy the drugs and you store the drugs, and then maybe you attempt to sell them, maybe you sell them. So you know, the further away you get from any actual physical activity, the less the charges resonate typically with juries. But all you really need is an agreement and acts in furtherance of the agreement.
What if it's not an agreement? It's just some people batting ideas around. Yeah, we could, you know, how much would it be worth to you to get him out of here, either by effectuating a rendition or by working through the legal process? I could use my influence as national security advisor to work through. We could pay $15 million for that. But it's kind of not at the level of agreement. It's more at the level of discussion.
Well, you know, the core of a conspiracy is an agreement to do an illegal act. And so the core of that is an agreement. Whether or not what you've just described is an agreement or not is a factual question. What you've just kind of described to me is certainly something that would be, how shall I say this? Something that might be looked at as a wink and a nod, that was an agreement trying to masquerade as a non-agreement. Somebody burned your house down, right? You know, how much would you pay to avoid that, right? Is an extortion, even if you don't say, give me money or I will burn your house down, right? So the exact context of what happened, what was said, who said it, what the understanding was thereafter, that matters. And so, you know, typically proving the existence of an agreement is one of the challenges. Mostly, though, it goes away if there are further acts in furtherance of the agreement, right? So however evanescent or incomplete the discussion that you and I have, if I then go out and conduct surveillance to figure out whether or hire somebody to conduct surveillance to figure out when would be the right way to grab up Mr. Gulen, you know, then we know that the agreement piece kind of falls into place, if that makes sense, right?
Right. So In your experience, I mean, usually when we see white-collar criminal investigations of the political context, we're not usually dealing with discussions of things like kidnapping, right? At the most, we're usually talking about is, you know, a kind of Watergate style breaking and entering, right? But we're not usually veering into the realm of what the Bureau traditionally regards as violent crime, whereas kidnapping is really a different kind of kettle of fish. And so I'm trying to imagine what the ambience of the Mueller investigation is the day the FBI walks in and says, actually, there's an additional element of this Flynn case. It's not just, you know, a possible FARA violations or possible kind of influence peddling or non-disclosure or contacts with the Russians in a sort of counterintelligence context, but there's this Gulen thing that he may have been working on. And I guess the question is, what happens within an investigation or within the Bureau when that information starts coming in? What does that look like?
Jeez. Well, first off, you're absolutely right. This is more of a violent crime. This is like what one gang leader would do to another gang leader in a turf war, or what a disgruntled employee might contemplate or something like that. This is obviously this investigation resonates completely differently, at least the violence side of it. The FARA side of it, the interactions between Flynn and the Turkish without filing a forms, that resonates exactly with the stuff that the Manafort indictments relate to. So that part would stay there'd be some coordination. But the investigation of a kidnapping is a completely different kettle of fish. It's witnesses, it's wiretaps, it's things like that. There isn't going to be a lot of documentary evidence of this, right? No written letters back and forth, no detailed bank account records like the Manafort one that had 60 or 80 different specifications of money spent. None of that needs to be done. So it's very different. It's not a forensic accounting examination. It is a violent crime criminal investigation, and that has a whole different set of tactics that go with it. I will say that probably their eyes lit up in some ways, in part because white-collar crimes are hard to prove. Juries can't follow accounting. It looks like a bunch of rich people yelling at each other. Kidnapping, assault, that's something that a jury can understand. That's something that is easily explained and easily understood. And if you have two or three witnesses, easily proved. You've got three people said, yeah, this was the plan.
All right, so help me out. The president, according to Jim Comey, asks the FBI director to drop the matter against Michael Flynn. This strikes me as an altogether different order of problem for the president in light of today's story. Do you agree or disagree?
Only if he knew that this was part of the investigation.
What if he knew that the investigation, just as a generic matter, involved some really serious stuff?
That's kind of a different. That's too indefinite for me to really speculate. I mean, when I read about the president asking Jim Comey to drop the Flynn matter, I assumed it was tied to Flynn's representation of Turkish interests and his failure to file a FARA set of forms and things of that nature, which would be improper of the president to do, but would be a request to drop a white collar type investigation. Not a good thing for the president to do, but if the president knew that the investigation involved a plot to kidnap Glenn, and he nonetheless asked Comey to drop it, that's a different kettle of fish. Where we are on those polls really is something that we don't know what the president knew. In some ways, I'm kind of tempted to give him the benefit of the doubt because he seems very uninterested in details or facts, you know? So all he knows is Flynn's under investigation and he's a good guy and I don't want that, which, you know, that by itself is deeply problematic for him. It gets more problematic if he knows what Flynn is under investigation for.
Right. So, okay. So, but it's fair to say that in any discussion of obstruction with respect to the president, the predicate offense of the obstruction, that is what was being investigated, what the matter was, potentially, depending on what the president knew, if anything, about this, just got a lot higher.
Absolutely. Also, you should put yourself in the place of Comey, right? He's sitting there, and the president asks, and he knows that it's not just a FARA investigation. That it's an investigation of kidnapping and illegal rendition of a legal resident of the United States to Turkey against his will, or a plot to do so. I would dearly love to be able to ask Jim Comey what he thought at that moment and whether he thought that the president was asking just about the one or about the other, or he didn't know. And
assuming that he knew at that point, right? Because the other possibility is that the whole fact pattern develops later and that it was just a FARA matter and maybe a 1001 matter at the time, but it becomes a bigger deal over the course of the Mueller investigation of it.
That's absolutely true. I mean, certainly if Comey was unaware that of the investigation into September and December meetings, then it's probably reasonable to suspect that the president was as well unaware, right?
A couple other things. Let's talk about defenses. So the big defense for the president here is presumably got to be ignorance.
Yeah, you got to be kidding me. Even, you know, I had no idea Flynn was that much of a moron.
But for Flynn, it seems to me there's kind of two possible defenses. One is that the events didn't happen, right? You sort of denial of the premise. The second is I was operating on behalf of the president. The president wanted to do something big and bold with respect to Turkey, really improve relations, change the whole landscape. And so at the president's direction, the president-elect's direction, I had a series of out-of-the-box conversations with representatives of the Turkish government about how to change the whole ball game. And there were some discussions of dealing with a persistent irritant in our relations, i.e. Gulen, in the context of those discussions.
I think he's going to say we were spitballing and brainstorming. And by the way, when this one came up, I said, no, we're not doing the kidnapping thing. That's going to be Flynn's defense is, you know, we were discussing how to resolve this. I encouraged them to provide us with more evidence of Gulen's involvement in the coup attempt. And we would, you know, I told them we would certainly give favorable consideration to a restated and reemphasized extradition request, blah, blah, blah. When one of them suggested, well, we could just do it on the quiet if you looked the other way, I affirmatively said, no, no way. This has got to go through the right channels.
So it seems to me that is a potentially viable defense, assuming you can murk up the facts enough, but for one fact in the story that is very hard to reconcile with that, which is the alleged or suggested willingness on the Turks to pay up to $15 million. And that sounds like, even if you're going through legal channels, kind of sounds like a bribe, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. No, if that proves to be the case, if there are credible witnesses who suggest who will testify that the Turks offered a payment, then Flynn's problem becomes kind of magnified, because even if he said no, right? Even if he said no, we're not doing that, and I don't want any money, then we have to ask, did he tell anybody?
Because he's offered a bribe.
Right. Yeah. If you're spitballing and some Turkish representative offers a whack job idea and you shoot it down, you don't have to, you know, hammer that. But if he also follows that whack job idea up with, and I will personally pay, we will pay you personally $15 million, you know, the normal response of any national security official is to, you know, say no, thank you, and then to leave the meeting and report same to chain of command, FBI, NSA, CIA, whomever, right?
Right.
As an attempt to bribe a senior official, because that's a much more. So if he did not do so, then he has the inference is that he was more open to the offer than he would now be portraying himself to be.
One additional question. NBC reported over the weekend that the Mueller investigation had enough information, evidence to indict Flynn, and they were squeezing Flynn based on potential vulnerability of his son as well as himself. I'm wondering how you see all this collection of what we might call Flynnformation all coming out at the same time. What does it say about where Mueller is?
Well, it says he's reaching a point where he can do with Flynn as he's done with Manafort. The interesting question is, why is this all coming out now? And some of this strikes me as Flynn's not so indirect request for pardon consideration. And so that's one of the possible ways that this is coming out. But the rest of it is just that it's clearly that the operational tempo of the investigation has gone up in the last few weeks, a month, based on this. And so it may just be that the inherent pressure is driving people who've been interviewed by Mueller to start speaking now. I'd be interested in knowing how long the Wall Street Journal has been chasing this story before they nailed it down.
I mean, I can tell you that I first started getting inquiries from journalists about this story in July. There have been a lot of journalists who have been chasing this story, not all of them at the Wall Street Journal.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go. Here's the last piece of the thing, which is really interesting. You know, kidnapping or conspiracy to kidnap, that's like real time. You know, I mean, Manafort, you know, he might think he's going to see like 3 to 5. Mueller, I mean, Flynn's going to, if he did this, he's going to see more time, I think.
And it does suggest, if there's a credible case to build against him related to this, that the amount of pressure that the investigation can put on him is very substantial.
It's going to be a testing time to be Michael Flynn.
Thank you, Paul. Good talking with you as always.
My pleasure. Stay tuned, right?
Indeed.
Finally, Susan and I talked to Steve Vladek, longtime Lawfare contributor and co-editor-in-chief of Just Security, about his impressions, particularly on the FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, side of the discussion.
Okay, Steve, first, give us your gestalt reaction to this piece.
Well, I guess my initial reaction is a little bit of horror that someone in a position like Mike Flynn was at that point in the transition would be engaged in that kind of conversation about what by all accounts sounds like the forcible removal of someone who might actually be entitled to asylum to a country where he faces who knows what kinds of persecution, and all in exchange for a lot of money. That's a pretty horrifying story to wake up to on a Friday morning.
You know, when I asked Paul this question, he kind of responded, I don't even quite know how to count. But what statutes, when you looked at that story, were you thinking about?
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, you know, before we get into the technical land of my expertise, I mean, there is the whole question of whether Michael Flynn and his son are part of a conspiracy to commit kidnapping. Oh, by the way, you know, potentially also offenses against Pennsylvania state law that President Trump might lack the power to pardon them for. But, you know, in my sort of bathtub, this really seems to drive home a concern I've had for a while, not just about Michael Flynn's exposure under FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, but also his potential exposure for a sort of related but distinct piece of FARA. It's 18 U.S.C. Section 219, which makes it a felony wholly apart from whether you've satisfied the registration and reporting requirements of FARA. It actually makes it a felony just to be a U.S. officer at any point at which you are acting as an agent of a foreign power. And if the Wall Street Journal story is correct, if as late as, you know, mid-December, Flynn is, you know, negotiating potential arrangements that would be executed once the Trump administration comes to office on January 20th, that certainly seems to underscore, you know, the potential liability he would have for being the national security advisor while engaged in these kinds of plots and contrivances and accommodations and arrangements.
So, Steve, just to sort of clarify on the 219 point, so the way the statute would operate is if he sort of had completed his contribution to the plan, and then no longer had any kind of ongoing relationship with Turkish officials, but was aware that it was going to be executed once he assumed office, you think that then triggers the 219 violation?
Maybe. I mean, I think, you know, there's an interesting question of whether if Michael Flynn, you know, had nothing at all to do with a plan that he put into effect once he became national security advisor, you know, I could see the argument that maybe that wouldn't be a 219 problem. I guess my reaction to the story, though, is presumably any plan to get Gulen out of the United States was going to have to wait until January 20th, when the Trump administration was in a position to actually carry out the plan. And so I don't know that you can, you know, I don't know that you can split this baby. If the goal was to find some way, lawfully or otherwise, of transferring Gulen back to Turkish custody, I don't see how that could have happened under, you know, the sort of late-term watch of President Obama. And so it suggests that more than anything we've heard so far in the investigation, a direct connection between Flynn's operations on behalf of foreign agents and something that would have had to happen once he was in office as national security advisor.
Okay, but Steve, help me out with this, because quite independent of any kidnapping or extradition plot, we know that Flynn was an unregistered foreign agent in this period of time because he's subsequently registered, right?
Belatedly registered, but yeah.
And yeah, he belatedly registered for activities that would benefit Turkey in roughly this period of time. So what does one have to do in order to be to cease being a foreign agent before one takes office on January 20th and thereby becomes the representation that would otherwise have been, you know, pedestrian if you registered it, becomes felonious merely by the fact of your being an officer of the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are to some degree in uncharted waters here, but I do think FARA could fairly be read as creating a sort of implicit divestment requirement, that if you're going to hold office and you were up until the moment you held office, you know, someone who qualified under FARA as someone who was under a legal obligation to register as a foreign agent, you know, I think you have to take steps to make sure that you are no longer operating as such. So I think that could mean, for example, having any invoices outstanding to a foreign principal under the statute have to be paid in full by January 19th, right? Have no continuing obligations, have no continuing contractual relationship. And, you know, I think we've sort of assumed since March that we didn't have the full story about exactly how Flynn's relationships may have persevered beyond his transition into the West Wing. I think what's so damaging to me about this story, wholly apart from the horrifying facts of it, is that this seems to put us on the far side of January 20th in a way that none of the prior reporting had.
So I'm interested from both of you a sense of where this goes from here. It seems to me we have really upped the stakes this morning with the Flynn investigation, and that implicitly ups the stakes with the presidential obstruction of justice investigation, since the president did, after all, ask Director Comey to back off of Flynn. And it all comes at a time when the press is rife with stories about how Mueller is squeezing Flynn through both himself and his son. And so let's just close out by, like, where do we think this is going at this point? Susan, speculate, get us started, Susan.
Speculate wildly. There's been, you know, rumors sort of for weeks at this point, including media reports that some sort of indictment is imminent. This certainly raises the stakes, right? We aren't just talking about, not getting your paperwork in on time. You know, this kind of opens up a whole new world. The story, it's interesting sort of as the day progresses how this story is going to be received, right? It's rolled out a little bit slowly. We knew about this September meeting before, and now, you know, sort of this new bombshell. So I don't know that it's really going to impact Mueller's timeline. One way that I do think it could impact kind of the public conversation and, sort of perception actually of the Trump administration itself and the way sort of the various activities of its inner circle actors bear on the interests of the United States is if people sort of use this as the opportunity to show, kind of the nexus between these individuals' personal financial interests and, you know, important national security concerns for the United States. So, you know, we do have an extradition treaty with Turkey. There's a requirement to sort of make a showing to career prosecutor or, to career Justice Department officials because we don't want to be handing over political prisoners. This is a pretty dramatic illustration of all of those sort of the cumulative norms of not respecting an independent Department of Justice, running roughshod over ethics obligations, really comes together in a pretty dramatic example of unscrupulous individuals, no concern for the rules, starting at the top down, and then actually, we could think about some pretty dramatic ways this might play out, with significant consequences both under U.S. domestic law, but also sort of U.S. international policy, geopolitical position. And so I do think that this is a story that has the potential to really sort of shift the public's conception that this isn't just, they're good businessmen and so be it if they make a little bit of money on the side, but the ways in which sort of the disregard for ethics and financial rules really does bear on U.S. interests, potentially in extremely negative ways.
Steve, what do you think? When you, everybody was expecting a Flynn indictment at some point in the next days or weeks. Are we now expecting a Flynn indictment for conspiracy to commit kidnapping, or is this kind of likely to end up, in your judgment, being noise in the context of an investigation that's kind of where it ever was?
I don't know. I guess part of the question is whether the Wall Street Journal story is a fairly thorough recitation of what the Mueller investigation has turned up, or whether there's more that didn't make it into print. On the kidnapping point, I guess to me, I had always thought that Flynn was going to be very vulnerable on FARA. That his belated disclosure in March just didn't feel like it was everything. And we saw in the indictment of Manafort and Gates that one of the charges leveled against them wasn't just that they had failed to register in a timely manner, but that they also, when they finally did belatedly register, the registration was materially false and misleading insofar as what it omitted. You know, I've always thought that that was going to be one of the big sticks against Flynn.
You mean the indictment's going to be you filed a false and misleading FARA registration because you left out the kidnapping plot?
Because you left out the kidnapping plot. And guys, this all assumes that there's nothing about Russia to be said, right? And that, you know, that Flynn's only conflict that triggered FARA was his relationship with Turkey. I don't know why we should be confident that that's true at this point. But I guess I would just, you know, to Susan's, I think, thorough unpacking, I would add two more points. I mean, I do think there is a pay-to-play sort of vibe to the story that is just deeply unsettling and that may shift the public conversation in one important respect. But, you know, legally, I think perhaps the most important potential implication of the story is if it really does expose Flynn to potential charges under Pennsylvania state law, and not just these kinds of, you know, technical federal financial charges we've been talking about, that also takes a pardon off the table as a way to sort of get Flynn out of trouble. And so I do wonder if one of the real sort of bombshells here is actually a shot across the president's bow that he may not be in a position to actually rescue Flynn. If in fact there's enough on the kidnapping piece of this to pursue not just federal criminal charges, but perhaps state criminal charges as well, you know, I don't think it should be that hard to see how if the president doesn't think he can protect Flynn, all of a sudden Flynn becomes a much more compelling witness for Mueller.
And what do you think? I mean, we don't have any evidence. There's been some reporting about cooperation between Mueller's shop and the New York Attorney General's office, but I haven't seen anything about interactions between Mueller's shop and Pennsylvania law enforcement. Have you?
No. And so I think one of the interesting follow-up questions is whether there have been any such contacts. Someone should find the Pennsylvania Attorney General and figure out whether these revelations, you know, have them in any way concerned about the prospect that, you know, criminal activities were considered with regards to a lawful resident of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. But again, I mean, we're speculating here. I think it just, you know, if the question is how does today's news dramatically change the tenor, I think Susan is much closer to the mark than I am about the sort of the vibe here. I just think that legally, you know, if it really does open Flynn to legal exposure beyond just shady financial dealings, you know, the exposure to me is on two fronts. It's on, you know, perhaps continuing to be working as a foreign agent once he was in office as the National Security Advisor, and it's on the far more serious and perhaps not pardonable, potential kidnapping offenses that we've been discussing.
But I think there's also a third element, right, which is even if it, I mean, as Shane described earlier, there was an element of these conversations that sounded like a kidnapping. And there was an element of these conversations that sounded like use the influence of the National Security Advisor to make sure the extradition happens, i.e. through legal processes. But if you do that in exchange for $15 million, that's bribery, right? And so
I think that's the significance, right? There is no good set of facts here. There is no like innocent, there is no innocent explanation. There is no innocent way of sort of like, you know, threading the needle here on it all being legal. Kind of every road leads to some kind of serious offense.
No, I was going to say, I mean, at the risk of tying two stories in the news together, I mean, there's a piece of this that reminds me of the Roy Moore developments, right, which is that there's no good spin here if it's true, right? If it's true, then, you know, there are problems in any number of directions for Flynn, quite possibly for Flynn's son, and then, you know, by implication for everybody around them.
Right, but I think there's two possible ways that this is not as bad as it looks in the Wall Street Journal story. One is, if the facts don't actually bear out the suggestion. That is, yes, Mueller is investigating it. I have no reason to doubt the Wall Street Journal's reporting on that. But the net result of the investigation is that either that December meeting didn't take place or that it didn't amount to what certain people think it did. So that's the sort of factual development. But the second, what about, I asked Paul this, and I'm interested in both of your thoughts on it as well. What if the, hello? Oh, sorry. What if the, what if Flynn argues, hey, the president elect told me to be big and bold with respect to restoring relations with Turkey, which had really atrophied under the Obama administration. I was taking a big, bold policy initiative to do that. And in our conversations, the demand was we need to deal with Gulen. So we were talking with the president's, at the president-elect's direction. We were talking about ways to eliminate a major irritant between the U.S. and Turkey. And by the way, there was no money. So that part is wrong. And the rest of it was just policy.
Well, so then you have two issues. One, in sort of having that conversation on Trump's behalf, you're talking about criminal conduct, right? So they're still talking about circumventing judicial process. Gulen is a legal resident of the United States. So you have,
and I shot that down when that possibility was raised. Yes, somebody brought it up, and I said, no, of course we're gonna. I will use my influence as national security advisor to push this through legal process.
Well, then you still run into an issue, which is that we do have this extradition treaty, and this is sort of a classic case of it being grotesquely improper for the White House to be asserting its political interests, right? The DOJ is supposed to be making a decision about whether or not Turkish law enforcement has provided the requisite evidentiary standards to meet the extradition treaties. Now, Turkey had asked again and again, in the following or preceding 2 years about, trying to get Gulen extradited, and DOJ again and again said, no, you aren't meeting the legal standard here. So on sort of that explanation is an explanation by which, you know, Trump and Flynn and whoever else says, well, it's in our political interests. So what we're going to do is we're going to pressure DOJ to change their interpretation of the law. That is also sort of a problematic account, at least to my mind.
Steve, what do you think? Is there any construction of the facts here that ameliorates it, other than that they're not true?
Only if, right, at that conversation, what Michael Flynn said was, guys, you know, when we're in power, we'll talk to the Justice Department, we'll see about what the holdup is with extraditing Gulen, and we'll do whatever, you know, we're legally entitled to do to try to make that happen, right? Short of that, I mean, I think this is all presupposing a commitment to longstanding, as Susan said, you know, norms and legal rules that none of the behavior of the relevant principals thus far has suggested anyone had. And so it's not just that, like, you know, you'd have to have a pretty charitable version of the facts as reported in the Wall Street Journal story to believe that nothing shady or illegal happened here. It's that you'd have to believe that all of a sudden folks who have not previously cared about legal process, about rules about international extradition, are all of a sudden putting their foot down because rather than, you know, making friends with Erdogan and the Turkish government and getting paid, it's their commitment to those principles that really took over. I have a hard time believing that at the end of the day, that's what was really going on here.
Steve Vladeck, Susan Hennessy, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks today to Shane, to Susan, to Ryan, to Paul, and to Steve for getting together on such short notice by conference call. Apologies for the audio quality, which may have suffered as a result of the surprising nature of this podcast. Our music, as ever, is performed by Sophia Yan, except that we don't use music on the special editions of the podcast. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast, however, especially on special editions. So tweet us, share us on Facebook, talk to us about your friends. We survive by word of mouth, and by all means, leave us a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution service you use. And as always, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.